Tango Tango Papa 1827, March 11, 2014.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Austinburg, Ohio. It's been several days since I recorded the last podcast. I'd actually have to go back and look and see exactly when it was. But in any case, I've been, if you've been following the videos on YouTube, I've been putting up a video every night. So far, I haven't missed. Now eventually something's going to happen and I'm not going to have probably not going to have bandwidth, or who knows, but Verizon, of course I upload these mostly with my Verizon air card and the Verizon MiFi, and that Verizon's got pretty good coverage, and so that has worked so far, so I've been able to kind of upload some pretty big files, as big as a gigabyte, which is, that's a massive file. You know, I was thinking about that the other day. You know, not that many years ago, you know, here I was recording my podcast and uploading it, and not that many years ago, I would have trouble uploading like a 30 megabyte file. And I remember, you know, and this has just been a few years ago, maybe 2004, you know, maybe 2004 time frame, maybe 2005, people were thinking that 120 megabyte file, oh, that's huge, that's a huge file. How times have changed. So, you know, it's pretty amazing that the stuff works as good as it does now, and but the people are, you know, it's never enough. Use, you know, the way people use stuff, it's been my experience that it always rises to whatever, you know, my use for something will always rise and meet whatever is available, and I think that's the way it is with a lot of people. So anyway, I'm at Austinburg, Ohio. I unload here at 3 a.m. It just so happens there's a couple of truck stops here at Austinburg, and so I got here, I don't know, maybe a couple of hours ago, and then I went inside and got something to eat. I stopped at a Flying J. There's a Flying J here, and then there's a Denny's over there. I'm sorry, Denny's is in Flying J. There's a Pilot over on the south side of the freeway at this intersection. And then back in behind the Pilot, there's, I don't know, it's some kind of a grocery warehouse. I think maybe Save-A-Lot or something like that. Excuse me. And so that's where the load delivers. It delivers at 3 a.m. And so I am here. And so I'll go over there, I guess, probably, since I'm so close, I'll try to go over there not too long before 3 a.m. and get checked in, and probably back into a dock at that point. And probably after, you know, get set up with lumpers or whatever, and then probably lay down and go to bed and see if I can sleep. These loads in the middle of the night are usually the ones that kind of end up screwing my sleep around. So, but I will, even if, you know, if it kind of screws it around, I'll still just sleep here, and 'cause the truck stops are here, I'll just go ahead and take a nap and time it so that It could be as late, maybe as 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, or in the afternoon, before I'm ready to go again. So, just have to wait and see how that works out. So, weather-wise, it's warmed up quite a bit from what it had been. It's, I don't know, today it was where I was at. I picked the load up in Boonville, Indiana, which is kind of in southwestern Indiana. And so the warmest temperature I saw today was about 61 degrees. So it was, I don't know, it was probably, was it noon? Maybe it was noon, upwards of noon, Eastern time by the time I got out of there with the load. So it was about, the warmest temperature I saw today was about, 61 degrees. And then, I don't know, now tonight here, there's still snow on the ground here, but obviously it's melting. Here, I'd say, when I was out earlier, the temperature was, I would say, probably around 50 degrees, although the wind is blowing pretty hard. Now, I've got my phone, actually, right here. It looks like it's cooler than that. So it's now, it says 49. It said 45 when I first turned the phone on, but then I forced a refresh and it says 49, so it may have cooled down and then warmed back up, because it had Austinburg, so it did cool down and then it warmed back up a little bit. So, but anyway, they do have snow on the landscape, and they've got some kind of piles of snow that they piled up, and that's still in the process of melting, but it's been cooler here than it has in other parts of the country. Of course, this is Austinburg is kind of east of Cleveland. It's kind of in between Cleveland, Ohio, and Erie, Pennsylvania, kind of along Interstate 90, closer to Cleveland area. And it's not that far from from the lake, and so you get the lake effect weather and what have you, and so that may be in part why they have big piles of snow here still that have yet to melt. But like I say, they've had, I don't know how many days of warm temperature they have had. I really don't know. So it may have been cool enough so that the stuff hasn't really been melting until maybe today. Who knows? So anyway. Sometimes I'll write down notes, kind of a thought will kind of pop into my head that I feel like I might want to talk about in the podcast. And so I'll go ahead and write down a few notes. And so, and that kind of gives me something to talk about. And it's I kind of like also to talk about these ideas, because it kind of helps flesh them out in my mind. And so I'll just kind of go through this list that I made. Today's bad news, because, you look at the headlines, and that's about all I do. I'll read an occasional story here and there, but I'll look at the headlines. And so today's bad news, really, it's what you're really doing. You're watching the moral curve that went downward, but it went downward, it was going downward in the, long time ago, with what's happening today, it was going down in the 50s and in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And so, and even if you're watching people that are fairly young do really idiotic things, well, it's because their parents failed them. The parents screwed their minds up, in many cases deliberately. And you think, oh, I wouldn't ever deliberately screw the mind of my kid up. Well, yeah, you do, because, the kid looks at you and you feel you're guiltier than the kid is. you're more depraved than your kid is, and so therefore you try to screw their mind around so that they don't have, so that they'll see you in a better light. Let's say, for example, that you know, let's just pick something out of the air. Let's say that you're not married and you're living together, and the kid, you know, you have kids, and the kid looks at you and, you know, and asks, are you married? Now, what's, you know, and of course you as the parent, or the parents, you're going to say, oh, well, no, we're not married, but it's okay. That's perfectly normal. It's normal for people to live together and not be married. That's absolutely normal. Nothing to worry about. So on and so forth. And people will do that in a thousand different ways, kind of screw with the minds of their kids. Because the kids, whether you want to believe it or not, is irrelevant. Kids have a built-in knowing between what's right and wrong. Now, it's not, it's latent. It's not right out there in the forefront. And they can easily be ripped away from it, usually. You know, and the world always, to a certain extent, the people around you are always going to try to force you to see them in a better light and not really see them for what they are. And so, but what we're watching today, really, we're watching this curve descended, you know, it was on the way down severely, in especially the started in the 60s, and then when those people reproduced in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, the curve was just going through the floor, and we were all not paying attention. You know, oh, live and let live, and don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and so on and so forth. And you look at the results that we have today. We're this close to a real dictatorship. We're this close to real concentration camps. You think, you know, oh, that can't happen here. The hell it can't. That's what the Germans thought. Another thought that, you know, we hear this term spoil. You spoil your child. You spoiled them. Well, spoiling a child, that sounds such an endearing little term. You know, oh, I spoiled it. Poop-de-doo, I spoiled my child. You know, and you really are spoiling them. You know, you spoiling them in the sense that you're soiling them. Spoiling them in the sense that, you know, when you hear the term spoil a child or an adult, because adults are spoiled too, but what you're really doing, you're creating a parasite. You spoil a child, and what you're really doing is attempting to create a parasite, something that is that can't fend for itself, that needs you or needs the group in order to survive, either emotionally or physically or both, because the two do go hand in hand. And of course, people are spoiling the hell out of their kids. Why do you think we have the problem that we do? And you think, oh, that's just an innocent little thing. You spoil your kid. It's just that everybody does it. Everybody spoils their kids. Everybody spoils their grandkids. And then we end up with a hellhole of a country and a hellhole of a world. So what we really need is you hear that the index of leading economic indicators suggests, or whatever. What we need is an index of moral depravity. If there was such a thing, I could just hear people screaming that it was the morally depraved would be screeching if there was such a thing. And you hear me talk about resentment quite a bit, sometimes more than others, but resentment, people kind of hang on to it like it's there is the wrong side of your ego actually gets a little something out of it. It's just a little split second, you know, some sort of a, like a split second reward almost, that the wrong side of your ego gets. And of course it's a lie, you know, you for a split second you feel like God, you know, like you're, you know, this is how God must feel, you know, when you're in your fantasy hurling the mental thunderbolts as if your thoughts could kill, as if you were God. And resentment is a funny thing. It comes packaged with its own denial mechanism. And so it's possible to have resentment. So you either have, you know, people will have it and it's buried and they'll never, oh, I don't hate my parents. And by the way, parents are always the first people that people hate, that we come into this world. They're usually the first people that we encounter and we hate them, even if they're not there. It's entirely possible to hate a dad that wasn't ever present that you never met. That's entirely possible because you're hating the thing that failed you. Because after all, a real dad would have been there, wouldn't he? He'd have been there for you. But whatever it is, you know, whether you think your resentment is justified or not, whether you're proud of your resentment, because there's plenty of people that are proud of their resentment, or if you're trying to hide from it, and you say, "Oh, I don't resent anybody," and then, you know, it's obvious to the people around you that you do, or and even at that, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's that doesn't really matter what the people around you think, that when it comes right down to it, that doesn't even really matter. What really matters is if you have the ability to see it, if you actually can become objective or not. That's what really matters. And so the problem is you hang on to resentment in a sense, in a very real sense, you're hanging on to your suggestibility. And so the more resentment that you have, if you have it and you won't look at it, and it's buried in there and you're in denial that you have it. You've done a very good job of distracting yourself. Oh, I don't resent. Generally speaking, you know, then the resentment, as long as you're denying it, it's going to grow. It's kind of like an infection in a sense that just sort of, it's in there and it doesn't go anywhere. So the longer you hang on to it, the more it increases your level of suggestibility. So the two things do go hand in hand. You resent, you become suggestible, whether you like it or not. Resentment being the sin, all who sin are slaves. In other words, all who sin are suggestible, whether you like it or not. And you can say, well, I'm not going to be suggestible, but that's like someone saying, I'm not going to care. I've heard people say that 1,000 times. Well, I'm not going to care anymore. I'm just going to stop caring. Well, try it. It's not going to work. You can't. You can't stop. As long as you resent, you can't stop. And as long as you resent, you care about what other people, what you think other people think about you, whether you like it or not. So you hang on to that. You hang on to suggestibility. So that right there, if you can see that you're suggestive, if you can see your own suggestibility and admit, if you're objective to yourself and you can see that you're suggestible, then just realize that suggestibility indicates you still have resentment present. Whether you are able to see it or not, it's always a good idea to always be self-examining, always looking. Because that's not something you want to hold on to. Another thing I've got written down here, people give human attributes to people, places, and things. And, you know, that's anthropomorphize, say that two or three times, anthropomorphize, and what that means is to sort of give, you know, like if you anthropomorphize your dog, or you anthropomorphize your cat, or you could anthropomorphize your phone or your computer, and you sort of give it human attributes, like it's like my computer's being stubborn today, or the dog's being stubborn today, or the cat really loves me, you know, so on and so forth. And of course, you know, now the cat or the dog might feel some sort of rudimentary affection, whatever it is that they can feel, maybe, you know, in the sense that you're the pack leader, you know, in the case of a dog, and probably the same way with a cat. You know, so, but do they really feel, do they, you know, no. It's, you know, maybe some rudimentary affection, and that's probably all there is. As long as you're the pack leader, as long, you know, and they've kind of bonded with you and so on and so forth, then, you know, you're part of the environment. The cat rubs your leg because he's marking it. You're part of the territory. You know, and again, they may feel some sort of affection. I'm not denying that. It's obvious that they have, you know, some emotions of some sort. Not in the same sense that human beings have. And so human beings will anthropomorphize not only cats and dogs, but things. It's the darndest thing, you know. I hear it all the time, you know, they'll do it with their computer or their phones even, or their cars, you know, and then they give their these things names. You know, like they'll name their computer, they'll name their phone, or they'll name their car, or maybe even name their house. I don't know how common that is, but I know some people do that. And the problem with that, they're engaging. The problem with doing that, you may think, oh, it's just harmless, little fun or whatever, and that's the excuse. You're engaging in a fantasy. You're engaging, you're creating your own little virtual reality lie world. The way I look at it, I want to see the world the way it really is. I want to relate to the world the way it really is. I want to be as aware of the world as it really is as possible. And not being, you know, engaged in, you know, kind of naming this and naming that and thinking that the, you know, the cat loves me or whatever it is. No, it doesn't. You're just the environment. And if it does love you, you know, it's not the same way that you think. And then the other problem is that people will think that the, let's say the cat loves them, you know, and they're, you know, they're rotten so-and-sos. And so they create this elaborate thing in their mind where the cat loves them like they are, as they are. You know, so, you know, they're, and they become, they use that cat, or they use that dog to become worse. And I think an exchange ends up going on, and that's why some cats and dogs are, you know, are sick all the time. I know a relative that has a dog. I have a relative that's got a dog, and that dog is constantly sick. And I believe there's an emotional exchange, this exchange that goes on, where the dog ends up kind of taking on the human disease. And but it's not good. It's not a good thing to live in a fantasy world. It's not a good thing to create your own little virtual reality lie world. And the reason why is not because I want to kill all your joy or whatever. The reason why is because when you engage in that kind of fantasy, when you engage in some virtual reality lie world, there's a really good chance your character gets worse. When you play little games in your mind, you got to be very careful, because you end up worse. Your character ends up rotting that much more, atrophying that much more, shriveling up that much more. Shame from the outside only works if there is something real inside. You know, in today's world, there are so many, at least half of the population in the United States, and probably the world at large, at least half, look like normal people. As I've said many times before, they look like normal people, act like normal people, but when it comes right down to it, they respond to what the greatest pressure is. Whatever the greatest pressure is, they respond to pressure. They respond, in other words, they're being dictated to by the outside world. So whoever the biggest bully, then that means the biggest bully, whoever the biggest bully is controls them. And they'll never admit it, because it's too painful. It's a very painful thing to admit that you responded to something, you did something out of someone else's pressure. You can admit the pressure, admit they were trying to pressure you, but then when it comes right down to it, oh, I bought the car because I wanted to. I bought that because I wanted to. I married that person because I wanted to. Are you so sure about that? Were they pressuring you? Did you act out of pressure? It's a hard thing to admit. I bought it, the house that I have right now, I bought it because the salesman, this has been way back in the early 90s, or, you know, maybe the mid-90s, actually, the salesman was really putting the screws to me. He was putting the pressure. It was high pressure. And I ended up buying the house, and I had a hell of a long, it was a hell of a long time before I could admit to myself that I did it because he pressured me. I wasn't acting out of my own sense of should I do this or not. The reason I bought the house that I have now is because I was pressured. And, you know, I was pressured. And is it the salesman's pressure part? Is it his problem that he's pressured me? No. You know, it's not good thing. It's not a good thing to pressure people. You know, I don't. You know, it's really not a good thing to pressure people into you know, this or that, or especially buying something. That's not a really good idea. It's not a good thing. However, is it his fault or my fault? It was my fault because I was pressurable. He was able to, in other words, he was able to, in a sense, he was able to bully me in to buying the house, and then I defended it. So it's a tough thing. But shame only works if you're going to shame someone into doing the right thing. It only works if there's something real inside. There has to be something real. And the idea that, you know, there are people that have the idea that there is no right, there is no wrong, it's all shades of gray. We're all just programmed animals anyway, so therefore we can just pressure everyone and we'll program them and we'll tell them this is right and this is wrong, and then we can shame them that way. You know, we'll tell them, pick something out of the air that, you know, like smoking is bad, so therefore that's it, smoking is immoral and you can't do that, that's immoral. But on the other hand, it's okay to kill your baby. That's really okay. That's an acceptable thing. You can kill your baby. Or you can, you know, if you live in Colorado, oh, it's fine to smoke marijuana now. It's just, it was illegal all those years, but now it's fine. Not a problem. Move along. Enjoy your recreational drug. And so there's this idea that we're going to reprogram everyone, and then we'll just shame them all into sticking with the reprogramming. And of course, that's going to cause wars. That's always the cause of wars. But shame from the outside. Let's say, for example, I tell you it's wrong to shack up. Or it's wrong to have sex outside of marriage. Or it's wrong to, let's say you're married and you have kids. You have little kids. And then I say it's wrong to get a divorce. You should stay together. You had those kids. You're the only mom and dad that those kids can ever have. The only real mom and dad. So therefore, you should stay together. You should take responsibility. And if that makes you very uncomfortable, the reason that it does is because, you know, or insert your own thing. The reason that makes you uncomfortable is because you have a conscience in there. Maybe you thought you'd killed it. Maybe you thought you'd buried it. And you think, oh, that's just this evil conscience that society somehow programmed in. No, I'm telling you that it's built in. With the vast majority of people, that is built in. You could say it's hardwired, or whatever language you want to use. You could say it's genetic, but it is built in, and it's not easily dismissed. It's not easily gotten rid of. And so if me saying, shacking up, living together is wrong, so on and so forth. It's wrong to be jealous of your neighbor. It's wrong to steal from your neighbors. You know, and you think, oh, socialism's a wonderful thing. Well, it teaches you to be envious, and it teaches you to covet what your neighbor has. So therefore, you know, it, you feel bad about it. And so then you think it's me that's somehow my perceptions or what I say is making you feel bad. It's hate speech. There's something real in there that you're running away from. And that thing that you're running away from is the only thing that can really give you peace of mind. You know, the idea is let it catch you. Stop running away. Allow it to catch you. Allow it to catch up with you. Make friends with it. Because if you can genuinely make friends with that, and I'm not saying it's an instant process, but if you can genuinely make friends with that, you'll have peace of mind that really passes any kind of understanding, any ability to understand. That does exist, but it can exist for you. But the very thing that you're running away from is the thing that, you know, you think it's bad and it's hurting you and so on and so forth. What it's really hurting is the wrong you. You've identified with the world. And of course, the world, it does hurt. You know, you've got this rotten side of your ego that's kind of like a parasite growing. And it is hurt by that. That part actually has to die. That wrong side eventually has to die. So the idea is stand still and allow that conscience, what you know of as a guilty conscience, allow it to catch up with you. You only really have to do it once. But if you're a coward and you're trying to run away from it, it just gets worse and worse and worse, and you have to have greater and greater distractions in order to try to escape it. This distraction, that distraction, food, sex, TV, movies, drugs, music, over and over and over again, and eventually your body wears out. Maybe you keep your sanity, maybe you don't, and then you die. You think you're going to die and escape it. And of course, when you die, I believe when you die, there's no more distraction. There's no more ability to distract yourself. Then it's going to get you anyway, and then, you know, there is no escape from it at that point. And if you spent your entire life running away from it, it's going to be pretty guilty. It's going to be a pretty bad thing to, you know. So you better be making friends with it now, as opposed to later. Do it now while you have the chance. So, let's see, what else do I have here? So when it comes right down to it, there are only really two spirits that wait on us when we come into this world. Of course, we have good and evil, and there's always this war that goes on between the two. And so we're kind of in the middle, but we've got this, we're really put to the test. God created evil, you know, and it says it right in your Bible. God created evil. He created evil so that it would put us as human beings to the test. You know, if you were God, how would you create a creature that could really love you? How would you create a creature that could really be consciously appreciate you as the creator? How could you do that? Because, you know, you could create a wind-up robot, or, you know, and you pull the string and it says, I love you, I love you, I love you. Well, what good's that? Or you create a dog and the, you know, or a cat, and the cat rubs your leg, but that's the way it's programmed to do. It's programmed to rub your leg. It's programmed to mark its territory. It can't not mark its territory. It has to. The dog has to bond with the pack leader. It has to. It can't. These things can't be anything other than what they were created to be. They're very sophisticated. In a sense, all animals are very sophisticated robots. They're very sophisticated instruction sets. And sure, they can learn a little bit. They can learn here, learn there, learn new behaviors. To a certain extent, depending on what the species you're dealing with. But when it comes right down to it, they can't they can't be anything other than what they are. So we as human beings, we've been given, we come into this world, we're given a choice. We can either make, you know, the right choice, but the wrong choice appeals to the rotten side of our ego. We want to be God. There's this proclivity within us to want to be God. And so therefore, we are attracted to the wrong thing. And we end up with the wrong controlling spirit, because there's really two spirits that wait on us. And so in order to find the, you know, in order to find the right spirit, we have to be subject to the wrong spirit. And of course, we, you know, the wrong spirit appeals to the rotten side of our ego that wants to play God. So if you have the wrong controlling spirit, you end up feeding on misery, whether you like it or not. Doesn't matter. You end up making yourself more miserable. You know, and then you, of course, then the next thing you just go back to, you know, you got all your distractions. You know, all this distraction and that distraction to try to hide yourself from the, from the fact that you're making yourself miserable. And that the wrong thing is in charge, and you see the right thing, but you always do the wrong thing. So the wrong spirit is in charge. The wrong spirit is controlling you. And you're enslaved to it as long as you won't, you know, if you can stop and learn to become objective, truly objective, it's possible to allow that, what you think of as a guilty conscience, allow it to catch up with you. Maybe a little painful at first, maybe a lot painful, but you, as I said before, you only have to go through that pain once. And then that becomes your friend. And life, existence, becomes serendipity. I look out in the world, I see people, the vast majority of people have terrible burdens that they bear, you know, and they you can see it written all over their faces, you can see it in their behavior, you can hear it in the, you know, what they talk about. They have terrible burdens that they bear, and oftentimes they're in denial of those burdens. They pretend like the burden doesn't exist, or they'll say things like, oh, it's all good. I hear people say that sometimes. They get in the habit of saying that. In that state, no, it's not all good. It's all bad. what can make it all good is if you can find the right relationship. If you can find the right way. You know, it's sort of a way of looking at the world, but it's more than that. It's allowing your creator to catch up with you. Whatever that, you know, just a lot, you know, and, you know, you may have knee-jerk reactions to my words and think I'm being religious, and I'm not being religious. I'm not a religious person. Absolutely not. You know, and you hear me talk about 10 commandments. Well, there's one commandment in there that I have a problem with. And I think a lot of people do, and I don't know if that was originally part of it, but there's this one commandment that says something about you'll honor the Sabbath day. You know, and you have this day where you go to church or whatever, you don't do any work. And I'm not sure, but, you know, I don't feel a darn bit of guilt for not, you know, because I drive, you know, I'll work, you know, so many days in a row. Day after day after day, I don't feel a single, one little thimble full of guilt for not sitting idle every 7 days. You know, picking, let's say, Sunday or whatever, and just not doing any work on Sunday. I don't feel a bit guilty about that at all, whatsoever. So I'm not so sure, but what, you know, whoever was writing the Bible, because let's face it, it was written by men. I'm not so sure, but what they didn't put that in there so that you would feel obligated to kind of force you into continuing to go to church. So they just put that in there. Now, I do believe it's a good idea to get away from work. And I do believe it's a good idea to rest. I'm not saying that those are bad ideas. But what I, you know, so what I like to do, I usually work about 3 or 3.5 weeks at a time. And then I go home and I take about usually 5 days, sometimes 4 days, where I'm just completely away from the truck. And then after that period of time, I go back to work. And I find that it's useful to kind of just get away from it for a few days. Forget about it for a few days. And then I'm ready, you're kind of recharged, ready to go back. But I don't feel any guilt whatsoever because I'm not, quote unquote, keeping the Sabbath and keeping the Sabbath holy or whatever that means. I don't feel the least bit guilty. So that one is iffy. Don't know where that came from. Wouldn't be surprised, and we'll never know. There's no way of ever knowing. Yeah, we'll never know. But I wouldn't be surprised if some, you know, preacher, or, you know, or some religious, you know, person or group of people put that in there to kind of keep people corralled and keep them in the church and keep them donating, keep them indoctrinated. Speaking of indoctrination, the indoctrinated, what isn't, you know, indoctrination, communists indoctrinate, socialists indoctrinate. What does that mean to indoctrinate? It means someone is kind of twisting your little mind around so that you'll think the way, you know, kind of pulls you into a, you know, puts your mind into a box. So if you've been indoctrinated with anything, and we all have to a certain extent, by our own upset, the indoctrinated cannot let go because they think it's them. So if you've been indoctrinated, let's say you're an indoctrinated liberal, you're an indoctrinated Democrat, you're an indoctrinated communist, you know, and you can't let go. You cannot let go of the idea that liberalism is good or communism is good or Democrats are better people than Republicans are. Liberals are better than conservatives and so on and so forth. And you cannot let go of that idea. The wrong spirit is in charge. You cannot let go because you believe it's you. You cannot let go because it's too painful to consider that you might be wrong, that someone pressured you into that thinking that way. And one of the ways that it's possible to apply pressure is to get you upset. Now, if you want to be a dictator, what you've got to do, just figure out the most horrible thing that you can possibly do. You know, let's say you're in some third-rate South American country. Third world equals third rate. Let's pick a third, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily, don't want to necessarily pick on South America. It could be anywhere else. It could be in Africa. Pick a third world country. Jamaica would be another one. Pick a third world country. And you want to be the dictator. What you want to do is just do something. If you're a politician, do something as ruthless and as mean as you possibly can. Get people very upset with you. As many people as possible. Bully as many people as possible. And they'll end up going, they get upset, you end up going along. Go along to get along, whether you like it or not. And once you've gotten upset, once someone's managed to make you upset, you see the kids do that to their parents in the supermarket checkout line. The kid, in a sense, the kids are reprogramming the parents. The kids are indoctrinating the parents. All the kid has to do, they start throwing their little temper tantrums because they want whatever it is in the supermarket checkout line. And then, you know, mommy and daddy get upset, and then the next thing you know, they're giving in and they're giving them, the kid gets their way. And the stupid parent is teaching the kid how to get his way, his or her way. You know, and then you ask the parent after the fact, well, was little Johnny or Susie, were they clamoring? Were they applying pressure to you to get them the stick of gum or whatever it was? Oh, yeah, they were throwing a fit and so on. Well, why did you give them the stick of gum? Oh, I wanted to. I bought whatever it was for them because I wanted to. Not because they were applying pressure. Oh, no. They were applying pressure, but the reason I did it because I wanted to. Liar. Another one of the nasty little attributes of resentment is that it causes the grass, you know, we've all heard this term, the grass always seems greener on the other side of the fence. What, if you really think about that, what is the root of that? Because it's almost like you look on the other side of the fence, and somehow whatever you have, because you resent, whatever it is you have seems like it's not enough. it seems like, well, somehow I picked the wrong thing. I'm at a disadvantage. That person over there, they must have, they have the advantage. I don't. Somehow I got the wrong thing. I'm at a disadvantage. I see people do that with their job. You could, there's a myriad of, there's a million different ways people take this idea, and you know, someone else has it better than they do. You know, someone else, the job over here, this job with this other company, it would be better. Well, I'm getting screwed. So resentment really is at the root of making the grass, you know, it makes the grass seem greener on the other side of the fence. And of course, usually it's not. Usually you know, if you jump from the frying pan into the fire because wrong looks right and right looks wrong, and then you end up because you won't give up the resentment, you think the resentment is right, you think it's, you know, either you're overt about it, you become proud of what resentment turns you into, or you just kind of keep it around and kind of hidden from yourself, hidden from view. But it ends up ultimately kind of ruining your life. It ends up, you end up making the wrong choices. Wrong looks right, right looks wrong. If you switch jobs because the grass looks greener on the other side of the fence, chances are you're going to switch jobs and you're going to find something that what was really wrong glowed that much more. And that's why you jump from the frying pan into the fire. You know, it might be that the spouse you have now, you think, oh, you screwed yourself with the wife or the husband you have now. And you know, you divorce and you try to find someone else. Well, you know, chances are, there's a really good chance you're going to jump from the frying pan into the fire. People do it all the time. The real problem is that you have resentment and you won't look at it. You can't see it. You run away from the conscience that could save you from it. You end up with all sorts of rationalizations. Rationalize this, rationalize that, as to why wrong is right and right is wrong. I mention it once in a while. If you go to my website, truckertompodcast.com, up at the top, there's a link that says meditation. Click on that link. That'll take you to a page where I have, there's about, I don't know, probably four links there, maybe five. I'd have to actually look again to see. But I've got those files hosted right on my server, and they will teach you how to meditate. It's a very simple meditation technique, exercise. Very, very simple. And the idea is that it will show you, you know, it teaches you how to bring your attention out of your thoughts. Whatever we are as human beings, we have this point of attention, a point we can only really be aware of one thing at a time. This point of awareness. Normally, people are caught up in their thoughts, and the thoughts go around and around and around. The same old thoughts. It's like a squirrel running in a cage, going nowhere. And the cage spins and spins and spins. As the squirrel's life wastes away. So this meditation technique will teach you how to bring your attention out of your thoughts and focus in the moment. In the moment, in the present moment, that's where real objectivity is. It's not in the past, it's not in the present, it's in the present moment. And when it comes right down to it, the present moment is all that ever exists. So that's there. Give it a try. I've been using that for years, and it has affected me profoundly. But the meditation technique itself is not going to save you. That is not salvation. What the meditation technique does, if you learn how to do that properly, it basically brings you to the present moment. It brings you to a state of objectivity. And in that state of objectivity, that is, that really is where you meet your creator. I'm using words to describe this, and you can have all your knee-jerk reactions to the words, and it may sound, it sounds so religious or whatever, but it's the reality of it is a lot different than what it may sound like. And what you realize, what I've realized is that, that my creator was, the creator's there all the time. He was there all the time. I was the one running away. So when it comes right down to it, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what your existence is about. It doesn't matter what your station is in life, how much money you have, how much money you earn, to your sense of well-being, none of that matters. It really doesn't. All of it's irrelevant. But that meditation technique, give it a try. If you find that it helps you, it's up to you to continue with it. Don't think you just do it once and feel better maybe, and then think, I did it once and that's all I need to do it. Or I've heard people say, it puts me to sleep. Well, have a nice little nap. You got to pursue it. Salvation's not an instant process. Becoming objective is not an instant process. It's not as, despite what these preachers say, it's not as simple as just reciting a little prayer that they've made up. And then you're saved, and you're saved from what? And then you go on sinning. Well, what are you saved from? Doesn't make any sense. So that's there. Give it a try. TruckerTomPodcast.com up at the top. So, anyhow, gonna close this off. Let's see what time it is. 1:38. So I've got, I'll probably go over there in about an hour. Like I said, it was about 0.7 miles away, so I'll go over there in about an hour and check in with them. So, in any case, hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.